How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, we have you covered. For a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. My guest today is Dr. Eric Green, the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the U.S. National Institutes of Health, NIH, as many of us know it as. Dr. Green's career has involved directing a major genomics research program and, more recently, leading the NHGRI's efforts in funding genomics research. Throughout his career, he has authored and co-authored, get this, over 385 scientific publications. We had to update this from the last time you were on, Dr. Green, because that's just how busy you've been since April. The episode I'm referencing there is episode 182. He came on DNA Today here, and we chatted about the Human Genome Project and the recent completion at that time of the human genome sequence from telomere to telomere. So in this episode, we are discussing the top genetic and genomic news stories of 2022, including what you listeners submitted. So thank you so much, Dr. Green, for coming back on the show.
Oh, it's great to be back.
I feel like you are the best person to be on this episode for. You just have such a wealth of knowledge, and you're so good at explaining things. I was like, you know, we even kind of hinted back in April, like, oh, we have to have you back on for something. And I don't know if I said it on air, but I was like, a wrap-up episode of the year would be perfect.
I think you had that insight because you could tell when we were talking about the completion of the human genome sequence, finally, I got very sentimental because I kept linking it back to the days of the Human Genome Project and what we could and could not do. And I think what you're sensing is, and it's partially the nature of my job, of sort of constantly taking stock of where we've been, where we thought we'd be, where we actually are, what we're looking to do next. And I've been in this business a long time, so I have a lot of things I keep track of, and then I make lots of connections, and I am sentimental, so I also constantly look for milestones and, you know, looking back. And maybe that's what you were partially thinking. It'd be fun to do a year in review. I'm sort of doing also decades in review, especially as we look to next year, you know, the fact that we're going to be celebrating, if you can believe it, you know, the 20th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project. And I do think there's going to be a lot being discussed and a lot of folks either who were involved in the Genome Project or who arrived on the scene shortly thereafter. You know, think about where did they imagine we would be a decade later or now 2 decades later. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about that next year. And so I think anything we sum up from this year is only sort of starting point to the kind of retrospective looks we're going to have next year.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And you really just pitched why you are the perfect guest for this episode, which is perfect. But yeah, I mean, as you said, DNA Day next year is going to be huge, 20th anniversary. So April 25th, that's like the holiday in our field.
Yeah. No, I mean, we're planning all sorts of stuff. You know, we never miss the opportunity to celebrate in genomics. And so, and we deserve a celebration.
Yes.
Considering 20 years later, I certainly didn't think we'd be this far. You know, when the Genome Project ended 20 years ago, I didn't think we'd be this far 20 years later. And I almost feel that way almost every year. You know, I think if you would ask me every December over the last 20 years, if you think back to the new year, did you think this much was going to happen in genomics in the year? I would consistently said no, because I just
and now we'll have it recorded so we can tell you next December what, if you were right, if you were wrong, you know, not to put you in the hot seat too much, Dr. Green. But so, you know, as we mentioned, so you were on episode 182, and that's where we talked about the completion of the human genome sequence from telomere to telomere. So for those that may have missed that episode, or they're getting nostalgic about having you back on the show and listening to you again, why is this a big deal?
Because we finally did it. You know, I mean, we also had a talk, and I know we talked about it then. It was important to people to realize, you know, was this just sort of a celebration that wasn't really worth celebrating, because didn't we do all of this in the Human Genome Project? And, you know, and there is some subtlety there, but, you know, the real hardcore, you know, perfectionist types, which a lot of us in genomics are and were, you know, when the Genome Project ended, we did the best we could. You know, we just did the best we could in finishing the human genome sequence. But the truth was, we couldn't get every last letter of the 3 billion letters of the human genome. It just was not possible. The technologies did not exist. The computer skills and analytics didn't exist. And so we decided it was time to end the project, acknowledge that it was, you know, a little over 90% of the genome we had sequenced for, and point to the really gnarly, mischievous parts of the genome that were really hard to nail down. You know, it was the centromeres, the subtelomeric regions, some other highly repetitive regions that were scattered throughout the genome. But I think the real triumph here is that there's nothing glamorous about that last 8% at first blush. It turns out there is a lot of interesting stuff there. But it's not glamorous work, right? The glamorous work is, you know, the big celebration when you finish the Genome Project. But slowly but surely, in the intervening years since the end of the Human Genome Project, as better and better sequencing technologies, and that were key, those came along, followed by better and better and more creative computational scientists that helped analyze the data and be able to stitch these really hard to put together regions of the genome sequence, getting those to come together. And, you know, it almost required a new generation of scientists, because if you look at the people that actually did it, there was only about one who actually was there at the very end of the human.
I was
going to
say, it was kind of some young people that we had
on
the show.
Young.
Dr. Migna and Dr. Philippi, I think.
And all this happened during the pandemic. I mean, the real bulk of this effort was all pandemic-related work, where people in this consortium, this telomere-to-telomere consortium, were interacting for the first time in some cases and working very hard together, and then they did it. And it's just a triumph of humanity that, you know, it truly is telomere to telomere. I mean, it is truly remarkable, because I remember so well back at the end of the Genome Project that we looked at that last 8% and we just said, I have no idea how we would ever figure this out. It is such difficult DNA. And our methods were just completely inept at being able to tackle those regions. But, you know, and it took like 19 years, right? So it took a while, but it's a reflection of the tenacity of these people and the creativity of the people advancing these technologies and figuring out better and better ways to use it. You know, and then of course, you get to the biology and, you know, 8% of the human genome. Yes, a lot of it looks pretty, you know, sort
it's really
of,
repetitive, right?
You know,
because you're talking about telomeres, you know, centromeres.
But there are genes embedded in there. But more important, and I always think it's important to stress this, is that the highly repetitive nature of those DNA stretches also make them very susceptible to rearrangements and deletions in people, in some cases leading to genetic diseases. So, you know, we shouldn't dare leave any nucleotide behind, especially nucleotides we know that could play a role either in biology or in disease or both. And so, you know, and now we have it as a framework, and that is forever.
And now we have that data to go back to. Like every time we're sequencing
absolutely.
A human genome of a patient, of a person, of a kid, whoever it is, now we have that to compare it to. We have a reference genome to say, well, do we think this is normal or causing disease? So, I mean, just all the applications there alone.
And keep in mind, these wonderfully talented investigators and trainees in the telomere to telomere consortium, it's not like they said, we're going to do this once and then we're going to throw away the recipe and we're going to go on to something else. No. They're trying to get this. Now that they've done it once, they're saying, okay, how can we do it again and again, cheaper and cheaper, more and more efficiently? And, you know, so and that will drive the ability to you know, maybe one day get a true telomere to telomere sequence down to something like $1,000 or less. Who knows? I mean, it's still an expensive process to get truly end-to-end sequencing. But now that they've done it once, you know, you could figure out ways of making it more efficient. So the work and the technological innovation continues.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and that we see, you know, our next news story, just like the genome sequencing arms race that will forever continue, I would think, or at least in our lifetimes. But you know, we have Illumina making big advancements. Nicole, one of our listeners, said Illumina announcing the $200 whole genome sequencing capability. What have you seen in this space, you know, particularly this year on those changes? Because, you know, especially as you're looking back at the last 20 years, I mean, you guys were just trying to do it. Not only, like, forget about cost. You were just trying to have it done. But now we're looking at, well, how efficient can we do this? Right. What else have you seen in this space with the arms race here?
Well, there is a you know, arms race in an affectionate business, you know, race. And we're standing back, and we love it because, you know, especially those of us that have either funded technology development in this space, mostly in academia, but then some of these academic, and this has gone on since the end of the Human Genome Project, this whole technology development push. You know, we fund a lot of academic work, and then some of the successes then get commercialized at companies, and companies like Illumina, you know, and any of these companies are using multiple individual components within their either their hardware or in their chemistries or in their software that allow them to put new platforms together. And, you know, I think most people in academia, certainly those in the government, we're not going to pick winners or losers, but what we certainly love is lots of options. And so, you know, standing back this past year, and seeing some of the advances in nanopore and companies that produce nanopore instruments, and then seeing some of the advances, as you heard from one of your listeners, from Illumina, because they've come out with some new hardware and chemistry advances that reduce their costs. And then there's this new company on the horizon that they were stealthy for a long time called Ultima, and they came out big and went public with their instrument, are starting to place their instruments in more and more places, and they may be getting down to a $100, $200 human genome, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone, you know, competition is wonderful. It gives us lots of options. Everybody benefits. In the long run, the ecosystem benefits. I mean, you know, in a business world, which I don't have to live in, so I can just purely look at this, I love to see multiple flowers bloom, and I hope they all prosper. But sometimes some prosper more than others. But all I know is when there is a race like this, or there is a competitive spirit, the ecosystem is better and everybody benefits from that. And when I say everybody, you know, certainly we immediately think about, you know, oh, wow, we can sequence people's genomes and lots of patients, and that'll make it very affordable, and we'll see it in healthcare. But if that's happening for humans, that also means that we can use those same cheap technologies and do a lot more experiments to understand how the human genome works, because so many of the experiments that are done for characterizing the human genome, finding all the regulatory reads and so forth, use adaptations of these sequencing methods. Oh, and by the way, if we could sequence a human genome for $100, could you imagine how many flies or how many worms or how many yeast genomes we could sequence? It means that huge, huge experiments can be designed that previously were just too expensive. And that means we're learning biology about all living systems, of course, all the way up to human, but everybody benefits from that, the cheaper and cheaper it is to generate the data. And so it's just every time there's a ratcheting up of one company and the other, or even the same company, you know, the ecosystem benefits. And so we celebrate, we love it.
It's driving the cost down by having that competition. That's why competition is good in science, because it challenges us to say, well, I want to be a personal record, or I want to find this gene before another team does. And so, you know, it's all in good fun and collaboration kind of with that competition. It's kind of a fine line, but usually, you know, they're two sides of the same coin there.
And it also means more people have access to the technology. When I say more scientists, I mean, think worldwide. You know, when you know, a human genome sequence is, $10,000, $5,000, $1,000, you know, certain experiments can't be done by certain institutions or certain labs or certain countries. All of a sudden, it's down to 100. You're just getting more people able to access that technology. And so it's just such a win-win.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point, especially, you know, on the show where, you know, we have a lot of Americans on the show and everything, so it is nice to take out that perspective a little bit more and zoom out to the rest of the world. Are you interested in the rapidly growing field of genetics and want to learn more about clinical genetics, molecular genetics, and laboratory science? Then you should check out the Genetic Assistant Online Training Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. By taking part in the program, you will be joining both national and international learners with the same passion for genetics. Interact directly with your Johns Hopkins instructors and fellow learners throughout the program. Applications are open now for the spring cohort, which starts on January 23rd, 2023. For more information, use the link in our show notes if you're listening to this through a podcast app. You can also access the link at dnatoday.com. The holiday season is upon us, which means we are all racking our brains trying to think of the perfect gift idea. Why not give the gift of health information? At Panacea, you can access affordable whole exome sequencing. That's analyzing all of your coding genes, genetic counseling, and physician oversight in a 10-minute workflow for under $1,000. This is astounding when you compare that to the average whole exome sequencing price of $8,800 just last year in 2021. By knowing your hereditary risk for diseases like cancer and cardiovascular disease, you and your doctors can create a targeted approach to help catch the disease before it becomes a problem. Their launch is starting with a resident of Florida, so if you live in another state or a different country, you can sign up on their website to be notified when testing is available in your area. As a DNA Today listener, you get 30% off. That's a $300 discount. Just use code DNA Today at seekpanacea.com. Again, that's code DNA Today at seekpanacea.com for $300 off. And to make it easy, the link's in the show notes. Make preventative healthcare a reality with Panacea. You've written even more papers, or at least been an author, on more papers than when we had you on. You're at, what, 385 now, I think, is our tally. So I can't imagine how many papers you've read, because those are just the papers that you've been an author on. So what are some of the top papers?
I've done that over many decades, so it's not like I'm publishing hundreds of papers a year.
Well, still, that's a lot. I don't even have one yet. So what are some of the top papers, in genomics that you've read this year? Is there any particular paper that stands out to you, or one that you recommend for listeners to read through?
Well, one of the things I would want to, point your listeners to, so first thing I'd say is I've been just delighted to watch, the advances across the entire spectrum of genomics. I mean, so, we talked earlier about the telomere, that was a great paper. Obviously, that had to be one of the big ones. There's just a number of papers that have been very valuable for understanding how the human genome works, more basic science oriented, and lots of exciting gene discoveries related to human diseases. But in a more systematic way, I want to make sure your listeners are aware that one of the things we've been doing for several years now associated with NHGRI is particularly focusing on genomic medicine advances. I mean, real papers that describe true advances in genomic medicine. And of course, one of the reasons that's particularly near and dear to my heart is, when I took over the directorship of the Institute, actually now 13 years and 4 days ago, but who's counting? But,
That's amazing, you know that.
Well, I know it was December 1st, so that's all. Yes. I know. And every December 1st, I think about it, so I'm up to 13 years. One of the main pivots that we did as an institute was and I very much drove this as the new director, was that, all right, it is time to now push the accelerator and start to do studies where we really are trying to use genomic information as part of medical care. So really implementing genomic medicine. I think up until then, there was a lot of interest and a lot of dabbling, but certainly NHGRI had a very almost non-existent investment in true genomic medicine research. I will tell you that not everybody agreed with me, and that's okay. Not everybody has to. Some people thought it was too soon. Some people thought it was just the perfect timing. Some people thought it was overdue. We were going to go for it. And one of the things I did right around that time, and it corresponded to when we published our 2011 strategic vision, which is when we called for the importance of genomic medicine to be a high priority for the Institute, is I created a working group of my advisory council. We have our highest level advisory group for an NIH Institute is called their council. They're the ones that sort of really have to look over all the grants that are given out, and they do lots of things to help you shape what your priorities are going to be. And so I created a working group then called our Genomic Medicine Working Group. And this was sort of the true intellectual leaders really who believed that it was time to to start doing significant research in genomic medicine implementation. And they've grown and matured and taken on various things, really helped us craft lots of ideas, host, you know, organize lots of workshops. But one of the things we started to do, I don't know, maybe about 7 years ago, 6 years ago, is that as papers came out, truly in genomic medicine, I mean, this is not about discovering the genomic base of a disease. That's not genomic medicine. It's when you actually change medical care in some way. That's genomic medicine. We said we should start cataloging this, and we should really help make sure we are showcasing the best papers. And so every single month, we now have candidate papers that get we find in the literature, and then we talk about it as a working group on a monthly call. And then a subset of those that we think are worth showcasing get put up on our website. And there's a website at NHGRI that hosts this. And we've been doing this for a number of years. And then about 4 years ago, actually it was in 2019, we were thinking, you know, maybe we should publish a paper once a year that picks the top 10 papers in genomic medicine. And so we approached the American Journal of Human Genetics, and they said, yeah, let's do it. And so starting in 2019 and then 2020, so we've done now three of these. And we just, and the one for 2022 just came out.
Amazing.
And so I would, I would urge your listeners to look at the American Journal. It's the December issue of the American Journal of Human Genetics, starts on page 2101.
And amazing. And we'll put a link to the show notes so you guys can just swipe and then click the link, or go to dnatoday.com. We'll have it right on there.
Yeah. And we can also put a link in there. There's a website on our genome.gov website called Accomplishments in Genomic Medicine. And so, you know, what's fun is that, and that's a contentious discussion among the working group, because you got to pick 10.
I can imagine that gets heated.
Well, you know, what really is, and what's, because it, and it, and for, and I really want to emphasize the reason I find, and I participate in this, and I help edit the paper, and I'm a co-author on it. And it, to me, it's a source of great pride, because, and it's also, again, this retrospective, like, you know, you sort of get to look at a year and say, wow, a year ago, did we think we'd see these things? And so it's very gratifying, but in aggregate, what's really valuable to me is, you know, hearing in the whispers from 13 years ago of some people being very critical of me and the Institute moving forward with this, thinking it was too soon, it was not going to be productive, and we've really dampened those critics considerably, similar to dampening the critics of the Human Genome Project about, you know, 10 years into the Human Genome Project. So, but, you know, so there's 10 nice papers. I was trying to see if I was a different way I could catalog them, because I don't want to spend time going through all 10 of them. But it's interesting because it really does, once again, hit the full spectrum of activities in genomic medicine. About four of the papers that hit the top 10 related to demonstrating how screening for a specific with specific genetic tests or panels are really important in disorders like blood pressure regulation or atrial fibrillation or hyperlipidemia, or one paper described how Lynch syndrome screening, which is very common now, is definitely being proven to be cost effective, which is a very important metric that obviously healthcare payers look for. Is something truly cost effective? So those are sort of screening papers. And then we're always looking to see, are there strong pharmacogenetic papers and pharmacogenomic papers? And sure enough, one rose to the top about for aminoglycoside toxicity, another one related to medications for depression. And then, of course, you always expect to see genome sequencing papers. And sure enough, you know, one talking about how whole genome sequencing is like the most effective way to truly identify repeat expansions that are common in neurological disorders. Another one talking about the UK 100K Genomes Project and how it really is yielding diagnoses that have clinical actionable options that emerge from it. And then a paper.
Yeah, and we did an episode about that. I think it was episode 208 about the 100,000 Genomes Project. And very early on in our show, we started in 2012. You know, I don't know if it was around that time or a couple of years into it, but we announced like, this is going to be happening. So it was cool that we actually got to like talk with people involved in the project and say like, how'd it go? What are you doing with the data now? So,
yeah. No, that's right. You know, and I have great admiration for that project. I think the UK is doing so many things so well. And now, admittedly, you know, one of the things that, and that's why I love to watch their accomplishment is they have such strength by having a single payer health system.
They do.
You know, which, you know, they'll be the first to tell you it's the best of everything, it's the worst of everything, just like the U.S. healthcare system. It's the best of everything, it's the worst of everything. But it is just different. But they get a head start on stuff because they deal with a single payer. You know, and then there was a paper, and actually I think this is sort of a something we probably should touch on more broadly, is just, you know, neonatal intensive care unit settings where genome sequencing is rapidly applied. You know, this has really gotten a lot of momentum.
It really has. It was on my list. Yeah, of looking at genome sequencing of acutely ill newborns in the NICU. Dr. Stephen Kingsmore seems to be one of the names that pops up the most when it comes to this. And he was actually on episode 172, where we talked about this a little bit. And for people that aren't aware, there's this concept of rapid whole genome sequencing as a screening for newborns to identify genetic conditions, either before infants get sick or like as those symptoms start appearing. I mean, this is like a game changer. I've been talking about, you know, this concept on the show for a couple years now, and just that in the future, I see whole genome sequencing replacing newborn screening, and that we'll get there. It's more a matter of when and not if, I think. But yeah. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, no,
actually, like begin NSG.
Yeah.
NGS.
So, I think you hit on something, and I really want to emphasize it because I think it's important. It actually is a reflection, and even the Kingsmore stuff, he'd be the first to say this. This is a reflection of a program that we started shortly after I became director. We did jointly with the Child Health Institute at NIH to look at newborn sequencing. And Kingsmore was one of the grantees to look at it in the setting of ill infants as opposed to general healthy infants. And the answers came back very different. And they still, I think, are somewhat different. I share your view that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when all newborns will get their genome sequence, but I don't think we're there yet. And one of the things I think is that people put it all together. You know, they hear, oh, there's this Kingsmore sequencing in NICU, and you really have to hammer that it is a very different circumstance than a healthy newborn. And that it is couldn't be more different settings. Healthy newborns, that's still open for debate. There's lots of discussion, lots of still research that's needed. You know, many of us believe it's a matter of not if, but when, but I would be the first to say we're not quite there yet. But I think what was happening around acutely ill newborns is truly game changing. And I'll also point out, not only is all the evidence showing that it's worth doing, is that you're seeing much wider adoption, but what I'm quite impressed with is you're seeing a lot of health departments getting involved at the state level, also at the federal level, seeing and recognizing this. And some of this is to Kingsmore's credit, because he's been a strong advocate, seeing that this is game changing and that we need to get this. And it really needs to be clearly delineated from, all right, we're going to sequence all newborns, because that's a different conversation. I mean, this is an acute, undiagnosed situation where the information could really help save lives.
And it makes sense to start there in the NICU, because these are babies that need an answer as fast as possible, because some of these conditions, like if they're progressive conditions, if we have a treatment where we could stop the progression, that's going to be so, so important. Thinking about a condition like PKU, obviously that's how newborn screening started, like with the right. Guthrie cards and everything. But taking that example of like, okay, for PKU, babies and people can have potentially no symptoms from that if we know about it once they're newborn and they follow what, you know, people have told me is a really hard, but a diet to follow.
Right.
So that was, I think this is what most of our listeners submitted. So Anna, Ryan, Daniel, you know, a lot of people said, this is what I think is the biggest news story and development of 2022.
Right. And you know, I'm sure when you had Stephen on, and he gives great talks, by the way, I've heard him give, I think, two talks this year, and one at least in person. I mean, he gives great talks. I mean, obviously, you have this incredibly compelling individual stories of cases and where you're saving children that otherwise would have expired. Yeah, I mean, so it absolutely is compelling. But what's also really important to keep in mind is at an economic level. I mean, it is not that NICUs are incredibly expensive. There, you know, every day in a NICU is not a cheap thing, and when a child starts to not do well, you could expend a huge amount. The genome sequencing itself is just ridiculously cheap in the grand scheme of things, and if it yields an answer that allows you to change clinical management, you can really make a significant difference, including get that child out of the NICU once you start stabilizing.
And they're getting results in what, 1-2 days, something like that?
Well, yes, like, I mean, that's right, absolutely.
Yeah. It's like, it's truly rapid. Like when we're talking about rapid whole genome sequencing, usually whole genome sequencing, I mean, I'm not ordering it because I'm in prenatal, but for those that are in the pediatric setting, you know, they're more ordering it or other, you know, clinical trials, things like that. But, you know, usually that's what, a few weeks? Yeah. I'm getting out of touch the further I get from grad school.
No, but I mean, in a NICU setting, you know, they the neonatologist will tell you this child has maybe another 2 days, you know, 3 days.
Right.
We don't come up with a solution. There's nothing we can do. So this has
to
be
rapid. Yeah.
By the way, I noticed the tenth of the genomic medicine advances, the 10th one described in our American Journal paper, I think is a really important one. I mean, I was hoping to see one, and one did emerge on polygenic risk scores, which, you know, really is at the edge of, is it really ready for, you know, true clinical deployment? Of course, I think the answer is not quite yet. And among the things that is holding it back is problems related to diversity, because it has limitations, because most of the data sets that a lot of the algorithms are based on for calculating polygenic risk scores have been databases mostly derived from genomic data from individuals of European ancestry. Now, all that we're trying to fix, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought the paper that was hit the highlight was a very clever paper that used, and I couldn't even describe it because it's way too sophisticated to me, but using very sophisticated data science computational tools to try to adjust for the lack of diversity in the data sets, and then doing some things with some other data to try to recover the ability to use polygenic risk scores in individuals of African-American category. And if we could have those advances, and we could continue to improve our data resources with respect, or databases and data collections of individuals of greater and greater population diversity, that's the direction we need to be pushing on if polygenic risk scores are ever going to be fairly and equitably used in medicine. And that's saying, you know, we have a lot of research projects going on now to demonstrate whether that'll be the case or not. But if it ends up being useful, we just want to make sure it's useful equitably and not just for a limited part of the population.
Completely agree on those two main points. I get on my soapbox all the time, like especially people that listen to the show week by week. So hello, people. Yeah. I'm constantly going on my soapbox talking about that. So it's nice to have a guest talking about that and not coming from my voice and my limited view on genetics. And you've got a little bit more experience than me, right? As a listener of DNA Today, you've heard me interview countless guests about genetic testing. I'm sure you've thought to yourself, I wonder what my results would be. Now you can find out or gift it to someone else for the holidays. At Panacea, you can access affordable whole exome sequencing. That's analyzing all of your coding genes, genetic counseling, and physician oversight in a 10-minute workflow for under $1,000. As a DNA Today listener, you get 30% off. That's a $300 discount. Just use code DNA Today at seekpanacea.com. Again, that's code DNA Today at seekpanacea.com for $300 off your kit. The link is also in the show notes. Are you seeking a position as a genetic assistant? People in these vital roles aid with clinical and research patient communication, data entry, genetic testing coordination, and administrative tasks. Therefore, training is key. We recommend the Genetic Assistant Online Training Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. This online program provides knowledge and skills to learners considering genetic assistant positions or those recently hired into these roles who need job training. This program consists of two 10-week instructor-led courses. All you need is a basic understanding of science, particularly biology. At the successful completion of the program, learners will receive a certificate of completion from the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the McCusick-Nathans Department of Genetic Medicine. Applications are open for the spring cohort starting January 23, 2023. Applications for partial tuition waivers to help offset the cost of the program are due on December 23rd. Don't wait. Check out the Genetic Assistant Online Training Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine now. Click the link in the show notes for this episode for more information. You can also access the link via the blog post for this episode, available at dnatoday.com. Another aspect I wanted to touch on is the changing landscape of genomic diagnostic ecosystem. So looking at just the business side, the labs, NVIDIA said major lab shakeups. One of them is like, you know, the merge of GeneDx and Sema4. and also Semaphore not offering reproductive options anymore. What are other things that you think of in terms of, you know, the big headlines this year from, you know, Genome Web is my homepage. So that's where I'm getting a lot of my news.
And I got, and then in other cases, first of all, I should immediately say I watch from afar. You know, it's part of an ecosystem I sort of am aware of, and I have friends and colleagues in there, and occasionally they're involved in some of our research programs. So I know that it has been I don't know if I want to use the word turbulent, but a time of change among that ecosystem. I mean, including, you know, some companies really having to get a little svelter. They had to lay some people off. There's a lot of some reorganizing and so forth. You know, I guess what I would say is I think it's from what I'm guessing and what I know is, you know, there continues to be this complicated uncertainty about the business model for all of these things. I mean, this plays back into genomic medicine implementation more broadly of, you know, who's going to pay for what and how profitable going to be and are they pay, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, you have these diagnostic companies out there in some cases starting with all the best intentions of being helpful. But if you know, at the same time, they got to pay their employees, they get, you know, they have investors they have to be accountable to. And so, you know, it is some of this is also a timing issue of when will certain things truly take off and who's going to be controlling or who's going to be the major provider of certain types of tests and so forth. And so it's a tricky time. And I, you know, we you know, it's part of the workforce we keep our eye on because sometimes, you know, either we hear of those companies needing people and therefore recruiting from our academic labs, from our government labs, or just the opposite. They get laid off and then they're coming back and wanting to come back to academia. So I think it's part of the inevitable growing pains of an area. And, you know, genomic diagnostics is certainly exciting, but it still has to conform to all the business principles and also is vulnerable to the general situation with markets and the economy. And so it's complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's been more changing and fast moving than I think other years that we've seen this year with a lot of labs having major changes, either major layoffs, mergers. We've seen a lot more than I think we have, you know, at least in the past like 5 years or so that I've been paying attention.
Right.
And I think one thing to mention too, that we mentioned on an earlier episode 211, that Myriad Genetics will be contributing to ClinVar databases starting spring of 2023, so next year. So
right. I mean, that's a big deal, and yeah, that's a step in the right direction. That's a great development. We cheered when we heard that.
Yeah, definitely. And I know there's been a lot of controversial opinions and talks online, and I think, yes, would it have been great to have this data a long time ago? Sure, but we're getting it now. I think that's what's good to focus on, and it can't happen all at once because that's just like physically, digitally impossible. So I think there's been some pushback on that, but from my understanding, you can't just give everything at once. It's a slow phase of adding information into ClinVar there into the database.
Yep.
And another point I wanted to touch on, one of my favorite topics is CRISPR, gene therapy. So what have we seen? What have been the advancements? Because every year there's advancements with CRISPR and gene therapy. What have we been seeing this year in 2022?
You know, I think several things. I will certainly say the buzz around NIH is a tremendous amount of excitement around sickle cell. Now, that may, you know, and just because there's just real patients that are getting truly cured in clinical trials. And some of it has taken place at the hospital at NIH, and so I'm aware of some of the investigators there, but some of it I'm also familiar with some of the trials. And so, you know, our institute's not at all involved in that. There's a whole other institute that deals with blood diseases. But there's a certain symbolism there that I think is really important. And the symbolism is that, you know, I often, when I give talks, you know, I often point out that, you know, the day the Human Genome Project began, there were 61 rare diseases for which they knew what the gene was that caused it. You know,
that's
now
it, 61.
61,
wow.
The day, 1990, 61, now it's 6,000, of course, that we know, or roughly 6,000. But among the 61, one of them was sickle cell. And so, you know, in some ways, we've had this genomic revolution, and the Genome Project's come and gone, and unbelievable things have come and gone, you know, is in the 20 years since the Genome Project ended. Yet, one could argue sickle cell has escaped, you know, much advancement, some advancement, but not seismic revolutionary advancement, especially with respect to cures. And if this is finally it, if CRISPR could really deliver, you know, the vehicle by which we can, you know, and do it in a way that large numbers of people could be cured, I would feel like there's something that we got done that we really needed to get done, because in some ways genomics didn't benefit sickle cell as much as I would have hoped. Now there's still lots of issues, and eventually we're going to need to make this cheap enough, and we hopefully will see this happen worldwide. There's lots of things to contemplate, but I do think the developments around that have been truly remarkable. I think the other thing that's remarkable is the fact that we're starting to see very rare genetic diseases now being in clinical trials, you know, real examples, in some cases real cures, with CRISPR, you know, almost always CRISPR-based, or just gene therapy in general. And to me, that's really important, because we really have to be able to reckon with the fact that we've got a lot of diseases out there. Some will be more amenable than others. But if each of these things is going to be incredibly expensive, it's not going to be private. If we can start to see this thing be very much more tailored to a small effort that could deliver a vector that could be used, you know, and we have stories of that at NIH, even at our own institute, our intramural program, a recent success story. And so, you know, that's really gratifying. And I think NIH is looking more broadly of ways to try to facilitate both technologically, but, you know, for vector design and the technology part of it, but also just trying to get the process down so that, you know, a small lab working on a very rare disease could potentially make significant advances that really can help people.
Yeah. And we've had so many episodes about rare diseases, including nano rare and ultra rare diseases. I think NLORM is a good, you know, resource for people to check out and look at. And even as you were talking about with the sickle cell, with, you know, the clinical trials with CRISPR there, I mean, yeah, I mean, we're saying the word cure, like that's in our vocabulary now with this. And it's very exciting. We talked with Dr. Sam Sternberg, who's the author of A Crack in Creation with Jennifer Doudna on episode 198. So that was really interesting there. And, you know, my gosh, I could talk to you for so long about this, but, you know, we're running towards the end of our show here. So is there any topics or, you know, things for listeners to focus on in the coming year? You know, I always tell people, if someone's like, oh, I'm kind of interested in genetics, I want to follow something. Yeah. It's like, follow CRISPR. Well, that's always my advice. But
I'll say something about the coming year. Maybe we'll see more of this. But the one thing we didn't touch on, which we had thought about touching on, I do want to give a shout out to Pablo Sfante.
Yes, thank
Nobel
you.
Prize, because, you know, there's a lot in common between his work and the telomere-to-telomere work, where it was, I can remember the days when, you know, he would present at scientific meetings just trying to get a teeny bit of DNA out of a teeny piece of bone and just getting tons of contamination and just not having the technology to really get anything that, you know, or just get some of the earliest clues that maybe there's some DNA there that you could eventually assemble. And this is a guy that just didn't quit. And I think a lot of people thought for a while this would never yield much. And now he's created a field. And there's every week, I mean, I think last week or the week before, there was this cool paper that came out about, you know, yet more understanding about the migration histories of humans in different parts of the world. It's just mind-boggling that what we are doing, it is absolutely like a science fiction movie that, you know, that you couldn't believe is true. And yet we're reading our history books through, you know, DNA dug up in caves and various other places. So I just think that's remarkable. So if we're going to think about next year, I'll just predict boldly with all my confidence in the world, there will be multiple ancient DNA spectacular papers that'll be published in 2023, because that field has just exploded. And I think the Nobel Committee got it right, giving it to Sfante. And I don't think this field is slowing down. So, and it'll be about all sorts of things, people and creatures and all sorts of things we'll learn that'll just be way cool. So
we're going to be like living in Jurassic Park, I think, right?
You know, it's just a whole different window. It's not experiments that, you know, we're looking back in time. It's just remarkable. So
yeah,
that's one prediction.
Really,
I think the other thing you're going to hear a lot about, I mean, I'll just tell you, early in the year at some point, you'll hear a lot about, and it also connects once again to telomere, is this idea that, well, now we've got telomere to telomere sequence. we really need to have new sets of reference sequences that will be useful tools. And and we have a major program at our institute we support called the Human Genome Reference Program, which is all about generating these very high quality human genome sequences from different populations. And it all speaks to diversity. We need, and this also relates to the polygenic risk score discussion we had earlier. We need better and better references that are appropriate from very, you know, strategically selected human populations, the best we can do. And eventually, the bigger and bigger, the more we can get, the better. But for now, we have to be strategic and select them. And you're going to hear more and more about this concept of a pangenome. And I don't know if you've done an episode on that, but if you haven't, maybe you want to bring some experts in.
I think we need to. Yep. All right. Look out for that episode next year.
This might be a word that's, you know, heavily used in 2023 is pangenome, which is just, it's a sort of a theoretical construct of trying to imagine having a reference genome of not of an individual, but a reference genome that not only reflects the human genome sequence, but reflects areas of variation across different human populations. And altogether, that's what a pangenome is, or a pangenome reference. You're going to hear about this a lot, and it's going to be really important. And it speaks to a lot of things we need to do in making genomics more accessible, available, and equitable. Because we want to have all people in the world represented in genomic data sets. We want references for all of them, and it's all going to sort of coalesce around a pangenome. And of course, next year we'll bring the 20th anniversary of the end of the Human Genome Project in April. So, you know, everybody should stand back in April and chill their bottle of champagne and help celebrate with us.
Yes, April 25th, that's the day. I'm sure we'll do something.
it'll be a great day, you know, and we have a lot, you know, geneticists and genomicists and many others who have come out of those fields have a lot to be proud of over the last 20 years. And I think we should celebrate, and we will.
Yeah, yeah. So get everything ready for that. And I wanted to give two listeners a shout out that haven't mentioned what their pick for the top of the year in terms of stories: bio-NFTs to enable families and individuals to establish ownership and control over biosamples and derived data sets. That's from Daniel at genomebank.io. And we had a listener, MSPDH, say optical genome mapping, which actually we did an episode 187 about that. So I think I've mentioned most people at least that have submitted what they thought were the top stories. Dr. Green, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, I knew you would be the perfect person, and, you know, you really showed up.
Well, it was fun to chat with you. You have enjoyable holidays, and let's touch base in 2023.
Yes, I think we will. And as for people watching the YouTube video, you can see I've already gotten into the spirit. I got my Christmas tree behind me. I got the red lights on. So you guys got to head over to YouTube so you can enjoy us on video. We've done video for 2 years now. So thank you, Dr. Green. And yes, we definitely will touch base next year, but, you know, I probably won't talk to you throughout the holidays. So enjoy the holidays. Happy New Year. And, you know, happy almost 20 years of anniversary.
And the best to all of your listeners.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnapodcast.com, where you can also stream all episodes of the show. We encourage your questions, comments, guest pitches, and ideas. Send them all into info@dnapodcast.com. Search DNA Today on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, so you can connect with us there. And a favor, please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. DNA Today is hosted and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our social media lead is Corinne Merlino. Our video lead is Amanda Andrioli. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.